Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Turning Points. This is the fourth and final episode of our Vanity Fair and Vienna series. Now, what I'm going to ask you to do right now is I want you to go ahead and pause the episode. Pause the episode, and I'll wait for you to do so. What I want you to do is go to your favorite podcast directory, take a minute, subscribe, rate, and review. We love getting feedback from the show, and the show's growing, but we need your help. Your subscriptions, your reviews, your ratings are a big part of what's helping to grow this community, and I'm going to personally take a minute to appreciate the fact that you're doing this for me. Now that you've done that, welcome to Vanity Fair in Vienna Part 4. If you haven't listened to some of the other previous episodes, maybe you want to hit the pause button and go back and listen to those. But if you like your stories out of order, feel free to listen now. For those of you who have been waiting with bated breath for this one, welcome back. This is Vanity Fair in Vienna, Part 4.
What are we beyond ourselves? It's not a simple question. Are we divine heroes or just feral villains? Perhaps a bit of both. Thomas Mitchell will be your host as we analyze the stories and events, both large and small, collective and individual, that shaped the human experience. Welcome to Turning Points.
Fans of history love their what-if scenarios. You can always tell a true history fan doesn't matter how compelling history actually is. And don't get me wrong, it's completely compelling. In fact, it's better than fiction. But true history fans, just they can't help playing with what-if scenarios, just tweaking things here or there, and then thinking about what the results may be. One of the more popular what-if scenarios from the 20th century is what would have happened if the former allies of the Second World War, the United Kingdom, the United States, and the Soviet Union, decide that they can't have peace after the war, and decide that it's better to go to war with each other right then and there. And opinions are all over the place. On one extreme, some people believe that the Soviet Union just steamrolls the United States and Great Britain. More men, bigger tanks, greater resolve, far more determined to take casualties. Just steamroll the United States and Great Britain, roll them up a wave just like they did Nazi Germany, force them up against the west coast of France and destroy them. You know, on the other side, you have proponents that say that the Soviet Union stood no chance against the United Kingdom and the U.S. Their manpower was essentially on their last legs. They had shakier supply lines. All the food and money they were using to prosecute the war was being supplied by the Lend-Lease Act. Their superior numbers and tanks would have been destroyed by the Allied Strategic Air Force. And the Allies would have been smart enough not to invade Russia. Which means that you probably have something in the middle. Early on, the Soviet Union rolls up the Allies, overextend their supply lines, run out of food, run out of money. The Allies counterattack and force them back. Either way, history's better off that that war was never fought, but you still can't help thinking about it. It's like that dread fascination to see an ancient battle from a hot air balloon just a couple hundred feet in the air. It would answer all sorts of questions and would certainly satisfy curiosity, but at the same time, you're, as much as you want to see that, you're even more glad. And I'll speak for myself, as curious as I would be to do that, I'm glad that I don't have the opportunity. The human cost to satisfy my curiosity would be too great. When we left off in episode 3, we have a similar situation brewing in Vienna, where the former allies of the Sixth Coalition are starting to have irreconcilable differences, and they're starting to form their camps. There's like the pro-Austrian and British camp with kind of France, the Netherlands, and Spain in their orbit, and then you have the Russian-Prussian camp. Things are getting more antagonistic over the issues of Poland and Saxony, and it looks more and more like a war will be the only way to resolve it. Certainly to the people in Vienna, the winter of 1814 and 1815 could be summarized as the winter of their discontent. and the possibility of their summer made glorious looking bleaker and bleaker. The real question for the spring of 1815 being, can their summer truly be made glorious? The problem you have when you're going to have even numbers of people voting or trying to come to consensus on any issue is you always have the possibility that you're going to have a 50-50 split. So when you're trying to reach consensus, what do? When you have exactly half the group on one side and half the group on the other, well, you try and avoid those situations. It's just like, why does the Supreme Court in the United States have odd numbers of justices? So on no any one issue will you have a 50-50 split. If you remember back to our friend Kissinger from some of the early episodes, Kissinger talks about one of the main ideas at the Congress of Vienna is how do we, or how do the remaining powers establish a new European order based on legitimacy? Essentially, what are the new rules that the European powers will play by to make war a last resort? Well, essentially, you have to have some sort of mechanism for developing consensus. Really hard to do when you have a situation where you're going to have a 50-50 split. If there's any chance of a summer made glorious in 1815, it's going to be, can the great powers find a way to build a consensus? And to do that, they need to add one more major player to the table. Within any story, there's always going to be multiple things going on. Right? It's going to have one big theme, and then it's going to have a bunch of little themes that kind of orbit around it, kind of sub-themes. And while this story is about a peace process, it's also a story in many ways about France, a reaction to things the French have done. Revolutionary France, Napoleonic France, restored Bourbon France. The whole Congress of Vienna is a reaction to France essentially falling out of the Concert of Europe. And in January of 1815, it's going to come full circle with France being brought back in. To counter the growing threat posed by Russia and Prussia, Castlereagh is going to propose on January 3rd a defensive alliance between Great Britain, Austria, and France. Now, the way this story is traditionally told, a lot of this has to do with Talleyrand. Because Talleyrand had made himself the quote-unquote conscience of the Congress of Vienna, it put himself and France in a position where Metternich and Castlereagh could turn to France and bring them in to an alliance to offset and isolate Russia and Prussia. The way Kissinger tells it is that Castlereagh had been planning this from the beginning. In 1814, before he arrives in Vienna, Castlereagh made a stop in Paris, met with Wellington, they had a discussion, or came to a consensus of the idea that France would make a very powerful ally, and they just have to wait their time till they could bring France in as an ally. Kissinger describes it this way. He says, quote, "By bringing France into the Big Four to isolate Prussia, Castlereagh destroyed the alliance he strived so hard to create for the sake of the very equilibrium it was supposed to perpetuate," end quote. Now, the treaty that Castlereagh proposes states that if any of the three signatories were attacked or threatened, that the other two would come to their aid with a 150,000-man contingent. And then it had a secret provision that said that Hanover, Holland, and Bavaria would be invited to join. Plus, and then you add that to the fact that Spain and Portugal were already firmly in the British camp, and Castlereagh was proposing then a system of alliances that would tie up the majority of the power on the continent on their side of the table. Now, if you're trying to isolate Russia and Prussia, namely Prussia, this is really great if you're Austria and Great Britain, but it's fucking fantastic if you're France. In fact, don't take my word for it. Take Talleyrand's. This is from a letter that he wrote to Louis XVIII, and it says, quote, "Now, sire, the coalition is dissolved and forever. Not only is France no longer isolated in Europe, but your majesty has a federative system which 50 years of negotiation would not have given him. Your Majesty is in concert with two of the greatest powers, three states of the second rank, and soon all of the states which follow principles and maxims which are not revolutionary, end quote. With this system of alliances in place, Castlereagh now feels that he's back in control of the negotiations. And so by his calculations, Castlereagh thinks that Prussia can probably muster 175,000 troops, and they'll probably be supported by another 260,000 Russian allies. So that Prussian Russo force, that total Prussian Russo force, you know, 450,000 troops. The combined British, French, and Austrian force that Castlereagh calculates he can put into the field, he sees as no fewer than 540,000 troops. That's not counting Spain, that's not counting Portugal, that's not counting all the just smaller German states. So essentially, Castlereagh thinks that he has 100,000 plus men to work with, and he has infinitely better financing than Russia or Prussia can dig up. Now, if you're Russia or Prussia, you would counter that there is a fly in the ointment here for Castlereagh. Or at least you could say this in December of 1814. Great Britain has been fighting another war for the last 3 or 4 years. It's a war on a different continent. It's known in the United States as the War of 1812. And it's sucking up a large number of military resources. Veteran troops, money, naval power, things like that. Well, all that comes to an end in early January when news reaches Vienna about the Treaty of Ghent, and essentially it's the end of the War of 1812, which means in a couple of months, Britain's going to be able to turn all that military force that they're wasting in the United States and use it for a war on the continent should a war come. Now, neither Russia or Prussia wants France to have a seat at the table. It's not in their best interest, because obviously France wouldn't agree with them. If France would agree with them, this would be a whole different story. And so, throughout December and early January, they've been doing whatever they can to make sure that they don't have a seat. With the combined news of the Treaty of Ghent and the fact that Castlereagh is able to put this treaty alliance together, they really don't have any choice. And so on January 4th, the Russian plenipotentiary Hardenberg agrees not to participate without Talleyrand. Now, this is probably a way of saving face and reaching some compromise. After all, he's been outmaneuvered. And Castlereagh had made no secret to Hardenberg, in public and in private, that Great Britain would resist with, quote, her whole power and resources if war were to break out on the continent. Now, by adding France to the Big Four, Castlereagh believes that even in early January, he's broken the possibility of gridlock. There will still be fierce negotiations to come, and he may have to rattle the saber. But by having a fifth power there, he has somebody who can break the gridlock and still maintain legitimacy. And in his belief, he writes a letter to the British cabinet saying that, quote, the alarm of war is over. And we haven't even gotten through a full week in January. So now that this gridlock issue seems to be addressed, the next logical step for the Big Five is to address this Saxon question. Poland, in principle, seems to have settled in December, November-December-ish. So now the lingering issue is Saxony. And so the dynamics between the Big Five are going to change. Throughout 1814, it was Great Britain, Austria on one side, Metternich and Castlereagh basically having similar overall goals, but trying to accomplish them separately, and the other side being Russia and Prussia. Alexander wanted his independent Poland. Prussia needs to be compensated. So we're taking land from Saxony. Prussia gets to absorb Saxony. And that's where we had our gridlock. But now that France has been added to the table, it's going to change things. Castlereagh in Great Britain will now act essentially as an intermediary between a Franco-Austrian alliance and a Russo-Prussian alliance. Now, I've gone to some lengths in the beginning of this podcast and at the end of the last podcast to illustrate the possibility of a war between the major powers at Vienna. And the reason I've included that is because it's important to understand just how badly the negotiations have broken down and just how contentious these issues are. I mean, it's 205 years later. You know, the importance of things like this are lost to us today. We have too many other events that dictate what's going on in the modern world to care about the Polish-Saxon questions from 1815. Doesn't register to us. Isn't important to us. But it was really important to them. So important that four countries who were in no position to fight wars were actively considering trying to fight them. Great Britain, France, Austria, Prussia, Russia. I mean, these three countries are in positions similar to the combatants of the First World War in like 1917. They're not quite bled white, but they are getting there and getting there quick. And if they don't have manpower and supply issues, all of them have some sort of financial issues. The country on the greatest amount of financial footing is Great Britain. But even the members of parliament are looking at each other, trying to figure out how they're going to pay for the last two decades of open conflict they've had with France. France has no idea, Austria has no idea, Prussia has no idea, and the country with the least amount of ideas, Russia. The only way Russia was able to participate in the War of the Six Coalition was financing from the United Kingdom, from Great Britain. Of all five of the major countries, Russia is absolutely in the least position to fight a war, even though they have the largest army. And that's a realization that Alexander is really starting to embrace. All throughout 1814, Russia had made no qualms that they were going to support Prussia. But as the possibility of open conflict got greater in November and in December, Alexander really starts questioning his conviction to support Prussia. In fact, it becomes real apparent in December that Alexander's not going to back Prussia to the hilt, which is why he makes a deal on Poland. Now, with the changing dynamic in January, if you're Prussia, this puts you in a very weird or very vulnerable position. Britain, Austria, and France have all solidified their position. And the scale seems weighted in their favor, so more than likely they're going to get what they want. France doesn't want any more of its territory taken. Austria wants to remain the major power in Germany. Great Britain's already got what they want. And in December, they essentially agreed to give Russia what they want. So if you're Prussia, you're looking like in a war, you're going to get crushed because the battlefields are going to happen in Prussia. You've spent two decades fighting the French, and you have very little to show for it. Prussia's becoming more and more isolated by the minute. So in a way to move the negotiations forward in a way that's going to benefit them, Hardenberg's going to present their official proposal regarding a settlement to the Saxon question to the Big Five on January 12th. Now, make no mistake about it. Prussia is dead set on being brought back up to their pre-1805 strength. Come hell or high water, they're going to acquire 3,411,751 souls. That's what's most important to Prussia. Here's how they plan to get it. They want to acquire 2 million plus souls living in Saxony, 800,000 Poles seceded from Russia, 300,000 souls from the Duchy of Berg, plus another 800,000 from central Germany and eastern France. That's their price. For participation in the last two wars, we get brought up to our pre-1805 strength, but we'll spread that out over a larger area. Everybody makes a compromise. Nobody's unduly burdened from Prussia's point of view. Now, Prussia not willing to compromise on the annexation of Saxony, but they realize that there's a sovereign king in Saxony. Remember, this is all about legitimacy and equilibrium. Not really going to work very well if Prussia decides, hey, we're going to annex a whole kingdom and throw out a legitimate king to bring us up to our 1805 strength and then believe that we can move forward with some sort of agreed upon legitimacy. So he's got to be compensated. So they decide that they're going to give the King of Saxony Luxembourg and some land between the Meuse and Moselle rivers. From Prussia's point of view, this is a great deal. Gives them 700,000 more people than they had in 1805, but argues that their compensation is far less than the benefit received by the other great powers for their defeat of Bonaparte. Untrue in the case of Austria, but, you know, that's how the Prussians are selling it. Now, if you're asking yourself, what's the deal with this preoccupation of souls? Now, as we've said before, even though we're 200 years in the future, there are some things at the Congress of Vienna that we see that are just thoroughly modern. We'd recognize them today. One example is the way public opinion played a role in everything that happens here. Okay, but then there are some things that we see that are thoroughly old world. Right? They don't translate to our modern era. And one of them is this preoccupation with souls. And when I say souls, you know, it was the word in 1815, in 1814, that meant people. And at the Congress of Vienna, souls is the unit of measurement that's used to evaluate the value of a given area of land. Land value is not measured in acres or hectares or GDP, it's measured in people. Nobody, and I mean nobody in the Congress, is as preoccupied with acquiring souls as Prussia. The number of people in your state dictates how many men you can put in uniform. It dictates the size of your army. Prussia's really the smallest of the big five, but it has one of the most formidable armies because Prussia has the highest percentage of its population serving in the army. From the Prussian point of view, they're in a really exposed spot because they can be attacked on three sides. So they need to have the largest possible standing army with the population they have. If Prussia remains at its 1814 level of population, it's only a matter of time before it becomes a second-rate power. In order for it to maintain first-rate power status and have a chance to become the dominant power in Germany, it's going to need to be brought back up to its pre-1805 levels. That's the Prussian thinking. Now, not everyone at Vienna is as preoccupied with souls as Prussia is, but souls are important. In many ways, powers like France, Great Britain, and Austria have moved past the idea that souls is the only evaluation of the value of land. Remember, we're in the early days of the Industrial Revolution. People are starting to look at things like the quality of land, its strategic value, the education and the ability of the people on it, its industry, as being things that factor into evaluating a given area of land's value. So within the process of negotiating how to compensate Prussia for the 3 million plus souls that had lost since 1805, Talleyrand and Metternich had stressed in their negotiations that souls aren't everything anymore. Not all souls are equal. And Prussia would be better off focusing on the quality of the souls that inhabit that land than the quantity. Adam Zamosky, in his book, writes a piece. He describes it this way, and he's talking about the thinking of guys like Metternich and Talleyrand, and he says, quote, "An educated shopkeeper, artisan, or farmer with his own land in a rich part of Saxony or the Rhineland was worth five times as much as a Polish peasant with no education, no land, no skills, and not even his own tools, eking out an existence," end quote. Remember, in large parts of Poland and Russia, you still have serfdom, and you're going to have it for like another 50 years. Whereas on the other end of the spectrum, in the United Kingdom and France, and in central parts of Europe, serfs are freed a long time ago. Serfs are a system of feudal economies. Western Europe doesn't have feudal economies anymore. They have they've had proto-market economies for years. These economies are starting to turn into modern economies. Industrialization's full steam ahead. To Metternich and Talleyrand's thinking, Prussia would be much better off being compensated with say 800,000 Saxons instead of 4.3 million Poles. And if they do that, Prussia comes out better in the end with less people. The king of Saxony is still left with 60% of his kingdom. And if this wasn't enough for the Prussians, Austria is willing to sweeten the pot with an additional 400,000 souls that it had received from Russia in concessions of Poland. And of course, the Prussians being the Prussians, they flat out reject it. Got to have our 4.3 million souls. Now, this is about the best the negotiations are going to be in January. The rest of the month is going to prove troublesome. The great powers are going to continue to posture and fight for position, all the while Castlereagh stuck in the middle, acting as an intermediary. But it's not as if he's a neutral arbiter here. Now, all the formal negotiating and posturing that goes on behind the closed doors, behind the closed door meetings of the Big Five, is going to play out in the streets of Vienna, as informally the Austrian, Russian, and Prussian delegations trade barbs and insults back and forth as they run into each other in the salons and the ballrooms and the whorehouses of Vienna. At one point, Alexander is going to become so pissed off at Metternich that he can't bear to look at him, which he has to do often enough on formal occasions. Alexander claimed on more than one occasion that he was more than willing to fight Metternich with pistols if he were not Tsar of all the Russians. And meanwhile, Castlereagh is still trying to keep all the sides at the negotiating table. He's preparing for the possibility of a war, but he's trying to keep everybody at the negotiating table because he knows a war is not in anyone's interest. And he does this by adding to the alliance that he had created in the beginning of the month. Now he's got Bavaria, Hanover, Holland, all signed on by the 23rd of January. And he's pressuring more states as he goes. Now, it's necessary for Castlereagh to assemble such a large force on paper so he can counter anything the Russian colossus might be able to send at him. Remember, there's a fear in Vienna, and not an unfounded fear, that all they did, all Europe did, in the spring of 1814 was trade Bonaparte for Alexander, the juggernaut of the French military for the juggernaut of the Russian military. Talleyrand, not to be outdone by Castlereagh, is going to add his contribution to undermining Russia's position. Talleyrand sits down in an audience with Karatowski, which, as you recall, is one of Alexander's main advisors here, who happens to be Polish and plays a big part in Alexander's plan for Polish independence. And Talleyrand informs Karatowski that if Russia and France have to go to war, France is going to do it in the name of Polish independence. And this is a shot solely at undermining Alexander's position in Poland. Because remember, Alexander hasn't supported outright Polish independence. He's only supported it as an independent state within the Russian Empire. In addition, Alexander's main field army has over 70,000 Polish troops. And those troops had fought loyally for Napoleon for years. So by squeezing Russia, Talleyrand and Castlereagh have put Hardenberg and Prussia in basically an unwinnable situation. Prussia's ability to negotiate effectively with France, Austria, and Britain is based entirely on the threat of force, and a huge part of that threat and force is Prussia being supported militarily by Russia. So if you're Hardenberg, this is the position you're in. You're trying desperately to serve the best interests of your king and your country. Public opinion back home in Berlin is demanding the whole of Saxony. Militantly demanding the whole of Saxony. And the military is right along with them. Yet the more and more you enforce that claim, the more and more likely the certainty of war. At the end of January, Hardenberg is starting to see war as more and more his only way out of the diplomatic position that Prussia's in. Prussia can't be relegated to second state status. To him, at the end of January, that's the certainty if they can't get what they want. And if they're a second-rate power, they're going to lose anything anyway, so you may as well go to war. Very dangerous position for a diplomat to be in. The point of a diplomat is to get what they want by maintaining peaceful relations. When diplomacy breaks down, that's when wars happen. Plus, Hardenberg thinks that if a war happens, it's the only way of holding Alexander to his word. Maybe. Alexander's a pretty mercurial guy, as we've illustrated so far. He only has to fight a one-front war. Very easily, he could sell Prussia out. But just not coming to the table. He's done it before. He's done it to Prussia before. Either way, it doesn't matter whether Russia supports Prussia or not. Any war between the former allies for Saxony, doesn't matter what happens, a lot of Germans are going to die. That's where the war is going to be fought. So at the beginning of January, we think we've kind of got the war thing figured out, and then here we are at the beginning of February, and it seems like war's ever more likely a possibility again. In fact, things are so bad in February of 1815 that Lord Liverpool, who's the prime minister, keeps trying desperately to get Castlereagh to come back to England. Remember, they've got parliamentary elections coming up. Castlereagh's not just a plenipotentiary for Great Britain, he's their foreign minister. He has a cabinet post. He's part of the British government. Liverpool keeps trying to get him to come back to London for the election. And Castlereagh refuses. Feels that his presence, along with Talleyrand's, is the only thing that's keeping the peace. You know the situation's bad when a chamberlain to the Emperor of Francis claims that they should bring back Napoleon just to unite the former allies again. And yet, while the sabers rattle in the diplomatic chambers, the band plays on in the ballrooms. As tense as the political situation may be in Vienna, it still seems like just mere side conversation in the backdrop of the spectacle and frivolity that is Vienna in 1815. The big four carve up Europe like so many wheels of cheese, and yet balls and dances are still occurring on regular occasion. In fact, these grand balls and grand formal occasions, where one might rub shoulders with kings and princes and high men of state, are happening with such frequency that it's going to cause a real problem here, because these august figures of Europe, these kings, these emperors, these princes, these highest diplomats, the more people come in contact with them, the more these august figures lose their luster. I mean, if you get to see the king once a lifetime, if you're lucky, doesn't matter what that king looks like. With all the pomp and all the ceremony and the fine clothes and the glittered jewels and the horse, these kings are going to look magnificent. You'd have no choice but to believe in the superiority of their power. But when you see them over and over again, you start to see the pimples. You start to realize they're human. You should see the descriptions or read the descriptions of some of these people. Some of these kings are fat, riddled with gout. I mean, they're really disgusting individuals. They're pigs with a lot of lipstick on. Now, the lipstick will hide that the first couple of times you see them. After that, you start realizing that these are just... were they not born royal? These people, some of these people might be the lowest of the lowest society. No real talent whatsoever. Except maybe the amount of food they can put away at a feast. Winter of 1815, respect for the sovereigns of Europe is at an all-time low. In fact, at one ball, the king of Prussia, Frederick William, is almost confused with the lowly footman. It's important to remember that within these societies, there are rules of decorum, especially involving royalty and its various forms of hierarchy. Those rules very strictly observed when these events kicked off in August and September of 1814. And by now, they're being ignored. Fewer and fewer people are even bothering to observe these conventions and these rules of decorum. For example, one states that everybody must be present at a ball before a sovereign arrives. And you have many instances where sovereigns are walking into near empty ballrooms, near empty salons. King is supposed to be fashionably late, not fashionably early. In Rights of Peace, Zamoyski states that, quote, by January, many balls were so sparsely attended that the sovereigns could not even find enough partners to make up a dance. Yet it never occurred to anyone to alter the pattern, and life went on as it had over the past 3 months, with nightly balls and the usual rounds of entertainment, end quote. And juxtaposed to that sad state of affairs, you have some wonderfully colorful incidents like this one involving the Grand Duke of Baden. So the Grand Duke of Baden, at one point, he's enjoying the company of Madame Lambert. And Madame Lambert is a very highly paid courtesan. So those of you who don't know the difference between a courtesan and a common street prostitute is that courtesans were very, very highly paid. So he's had his fun, the evening's over, and he wants to leave. So the Grand Duke hands her 25 florins in paper money. Now, I don't know how much 25 florins was back then, but apparently it wasn't very much. But Madame Lambert was so offended at his apparent disregard for her skills that she pulls 50 florins out of her own wallet, combines them with the Duke's 25, thrusts them into his hand, and then promptly pushes his ass out the door. Imagine if this whole, if the Congress of Vienna was a miniseries and you threw that scene in there. Like, people will look at it and just think, oh, that's just a gratuitous. That's just there so you can introduce sex into the whole thing. This is little things like this, these little colorful details like this is why I think history is so much better than fiction. Negotiations at Vienna, they're starting to take on the qualities of like a war. And what I mean by that is you'll see these recurring actions, right? You'll see negotiations on a certain issue go on for weeks and months. And it's the same thing over and over and over again. It's just posturing, right? If it was a military campaign, it'd be all the little shading. We're bringing in troops, we're redeploying them, we're shading here, we're shoring up our supply lines. Same thing, we keep rehashing this issue. We're looking for little concessions here and there. How can we negotiate or how can we improve our negotiating position just a little bit? And it's always going on in the background. And then every once in a while, you'll have things come to a head and you'll have some movement. And you'll have more days and weeks and months of negotiating till we get to a point where, you know, we have another thing come to a head. And now we can move things forward again. So whether it's negotiation on the Saxon question or the Polish question or talking about trade rights among navigable rivers or, you know, discussing the slave trade or Jewish rights or Liverpool trying to recall Castlereagh, doesn't really matter. Like, these things are always constantly going on in the background and like these themes that we grab hold of, all these little storylines that we're trying to tie together. And that's what keeps going on through the first couple of months of 1815. Now, one of these big moments that starts to break up, you know, the constant negotiating and posturing and things that's going on in the background is there's going to be a change of leadership on the British side. Because in February 1st of 1815, the Duke of Wellington, who's been serving as a British ambassador to the court of Louis XVIII, is going to arrive in Vienna to take over for Castlereagh so Castlereagh can go back to London. Now, Castlereagh's got a bunch of loose ends to tie up, and it'll take a little bit to have the changing of the guard, so to speak, but that's going to happen. Castlereagh wants to tie up all his loose ends, including Saxony, before he has to leave. So in the first couple of days of February, he has meetings with Prussia and Russia. February 3, he meets with Frederick William and Prince Hardenberg of the Prussians. On the 4th, he meets with Alexander. Neither meeting goes particularly well. By this time, Prussia knows they're not going to be able to keep the whole of Saxony, but they want to hold on to some really important stuff in it. One of those things being the city of Leipzig. Leipzig is the capital of Saxony. Castlereagh describes the proceedings as painful, and Castlereagh half expects that he's going to have the same fights with Alexander that he just had with the Prussians. And his pleasant surprise, Alexander seems in a reasonable mood. And Alexander would like this. As we said, he was a mercurial guy. Depends on the day you cut him. Sometimes he was in a really reasonable and charitable mood. Other times he wasn't. So apparently Alexander had a conversation with Wellington at a party back on February 2nd. And in that conversation, Alexander's digging for information on the state of the French army from Wellington, because he's been there for a while. Tells Wellington that it's his understanding that the French army's in shambles, and that Louis' reign is deeply unpopular. Wellington's response is basically that Alexander is very misinformed, French army's well-organized and in good fighting shape. Louis' popularity is fine. Alexander, now knowing that the French army is fully capable of supporting the Austrians, he seemed in a much more conciliatory mood, much more keen on easing the tensions with Prussia. So Castlereagh suggests to the Russian Tsar that perhaps both sides make some concessions soften the blow to the Prussian pride that they're not going to be able to keep Leipzig. Alexander agrees with Castlereagh's suggestion, puts together a deal that would basically trade the city of Thorn for the city of Leipzig. Prussia gets a nice little city in Thorn. Saxony gets to keep their capital city in Leipzig. So Castlereagh takes that deal to Hardenberg later that night. He explains that he and Alexander put this together for Hardenberg, asks him to convince Frederick William to give up his claim on Leipzig for the city of Thorn, and Castlereagh basically convinces Hardenberg to persuade Frederick William to give up his claim to Leipzig for a quid pro quo deal for the city of Thorn. Next day, Hardenberg goes to Alexander to confirm the offer. 2 days later, he has a meeting with his own king to try and convince him to take the deal. So at the meeting of the Big Five on February 8th, Hardenberg accepts the deal. But remember, anything that you do at these formal meetings, you just can't do. Like, you just can't say, hey, we're going to accept the deal. You've got a posture for your side, because everything's a negotiation. If you just say, hey, that's really nice, we'll take that deal, thank you very much, you have no negotiating power. So Hardenberg has to make a big show of just how much Prussia sacrificed and how little she has to show for it and how bad the Saxon deal is for them and how much the other powers have benefited. But that to be good guys, they're going to agree to take this deal in the end to move things forward. Metternich says that, hey, I need to get approval from my king, but I feel safe in accepting the Prussians' offer. So the members of the Big Five sign the meeting minutes as a basic acceptance in principle, that we have a deal, we need some fine details we need to work at as we go, but we seem to have an agreement that's going to satisfy this Polish-Saxon question. So by mid-February, it seems that there's finally an agreement reached on the Polish-Saxon question that has plagued the negotiations at Vienna since September of 1814. All right, so remember, we have a situation over Poland and a situation over Saxony. So here's the deal in Saxony. The deal in Saxony, Russia gets to keep the remainder of the Grand Duchy of Warsaw and incorporate it as an independent kingdom within the Russian Empire. That means that the 3.2 million people of the Kingdom of Poland are now ruled by the Tsar. Austria, for giving up its claim in Poland, gets to keep Galicia and the district of Tarnopol, and Krakow becomes a free city. Prussia, for giving up its claim, gets the district of Posen, and Thorn becomes a free city. In Saxony, Prussia obtains 40% of Saxony, Swedish Pomerania, and most of the left bank of the Rhine, and the Duchy of Westphalia. For their acceptance, Austria retains control of northern Italy with no outside influence. And the King of Saxony, for letting this whole thing happen, for agreeing to give up 40% of his kingdom, gets to keep 3/5 of his land and 2/3 of his subjects. With those agreements in place, Castlereagh's work in Vienna is essentially done. It's time to go back to England, which he does, departing at 10 a.m. in the morning of February 15th, 1815. Wellington's going to take over Castlereagh's duties as the English plenipotentiary, that all the work he had done there, along with the other plenipotentiaries, would go into essentially a final declaration to be ratified by all of Europe. So he had put together a draft of what this might look like with an accompanying note that said, quote, "May security, confidence, and hope revive everywhere, and with them peaceful labors, progress in industry, and prosperity, both public and private. May somber anxiety for the future not awaken or bring back the evils who return the sovereigns would wish to prevent and whose last trace they would like to efface. May religious feeling, respect for established authority, obedience to law, and the horror of everything that might disrupt public order once again become the indissoluble ties of civil and political society. May fraternal relations, mutually useful and beneficial, be reestablished between all lands. May all rivalry, other than that which aspires to the noble desire to equal or surpass one's neighbor in the virtues which do honor to the human race, in the arts which elevate it, and the talents that adorn it disappear from a pacified Europe. And may homage at last be rendered to that eternal principle that there can be for nations, as for individuals, no real happiness but in the prosperity of all." End quote. Throughout this series, I'm constantly amazed by the hope that a lot of these very hard-bitten, very cynical men must have had for a future, even in a backdrop and daily grind of everyday realpolitik, which seems totally at odds with this high-minded enthusiasm they had for a better future. Most of February 1815 is spent tying up loose ends. And they're all very interesting in one degree or another, but taken in the totality of the things happening at Vienna that are going to last, they're just mere side projects, right? For instance, one is the idea of abolishing the slave trade in Europe. And this was actually a pet project of Castlereagh's, right? This was his high-minded ideal. But he's never going to see it come to fruition because, again, taken with the totality of everything he had to do there, is just a mere hobby at that point when put up against questions like Poland and Saxony and questions of security and questions of legitimacy. Another one of these side projects is the rights of Jews. Another is the fate of Switzerland. Now, Switzerland is actually worth talking about for a minute because Switzerland represents a microcosm of the way the conference played out. Now, I could sit here and try and summarize it. It's probably going to be better coming from author Adam Zamosky, who talks about it in Rights of Peace. And he says, quote, "The Committee of Swiss Affairs was a perfect example of what was wrong with the whole Congress. The, quote, intervening powers represented in the committees were ostensibly there to adjudicate impartially on both the internal disputes between the cantons and on a number of minor border adjustments, none of which touched on the vital interests of any but the Swiss. But as each of the five powers had in its own clients in Switzerland, and as each of them engaged in negotiations with the other on entirely different matters, the consequence was that far from being addressed dispassionately, the affairs of Switzerland were dragged into the power struggle over Poland and Saxony," end quote. And it's not like there's just a few of these side projects. There were many, like the fate of the Papal State, what would happen in Holland. And here's one that was important, but we've talked about little to this point, Italy. And Italy's the only side project of real note. And developments have been going on in Italy since the early days of the Congress in 1814, but we haven't talked about it much because it hasn't been much of a factor. Well, Italy's about to become a factor, but it's only going to become a factor because of what's going to happen next. And while this story has been about a peace conference that has defined the Western world for the last 200 years, this is also a story about a man. One man, his desires, and the world's reaction to him. It's a story about Napoleon. And he hasn't really been around much. We talked a little bit about him in episode 1, in episode 2, to really set the stage. He's impacted this story, but he's been a peripheral character. And that's going to change as he comes. On March 17th, 1815, Metternich gets one of history's, well, how shall we call it? He gets one of history's more unpleasant surprises. After getting in at 3 a.m. in the morning from a meeting of the Big Five, Metternich is wiped. He's tired. He wants nothing more than to go to bed, so he instructs his valet that his rest is not to be disturbed. So when a courier arrives a couple hours later with a message marked urgent, Metternich's valet is confronted with a bit of a conundrum. Does he follow his boss's strict instructions not to be disturbed, or does he realize that a messenger arriving in the wee hours of a morning with a diplomatic package marked urgent warrant interrupting his master's sleep? Now, maybe his valet didn't like Metternich, maybe he's just erring on the side of caution, but the valet decides to wake Metternich anyway and deliver the envelope. Metternich, who we can only assume was not excited about being awoken early, takes one look at the envelope, tosses it on the bedside table, and then tries to go back to sleep. Now, if you're anything like me, when you're awakened in the wee hours of the morning, exhausted from the night before, it can be a little hard to get back to sleep. And that's exactly what happens for Metternich. He tosses and turns for a little while, trying desperately to go back to sleep but can't. So frustrated that he's unable to go back to sleep, he does the only sensible thing that he can and opens the letter. And this urgent letter contains just the briefest of notes. And it goes like this. Quote, "The English Commissioner Campbell has just sailed into the Genoa harbor to inquire whether there has been any sighting of Napoleon, given that he has disappeared from the island of Elba. The answer being negative, the English frigate put to sea without delay." End quote. With alarm bells ringing in his head of clear distress, Metternich leaps out of bed, dresses, which is not an easy thing in the early 19th century, and is in his emperor's chambers by 8 a.m. He's in the chambers of the Emperor Alexander 15 minutes later. In the entire Congress, there was no news so urgent as that Metternich received on the morning of March 7th. Now again, Metternich is receiving news of this on March 7th. Napoleon had actually made his escape from the island of Elba back on February 26th. He's been gone for 9 days without anybody who mattered knowing where he was. So now, what's Napoleon been up to this whole time? Well, for the past 9 months, he's been hanging out on the island of Elba, which is in the Bay of Naples. As you may recall from episode 2, Napoleon's fate was sealed the previous year in 1814 at the Treaty of Fontainebleau, back in the spring. Most of the Allies wanted Napoleon relegated off to some far-flung island and somewhere in the South Atlantic. This would include Metternich and Castlereagh. The Prussians were certainly the most vocal, but unfortunately for them, they weren't able to negotiate the treaty. The treaty was negotiated exclusively between Talleyrand and Tsar Alexander. Now, in the spring of 1814, Alexander was certainly in one of his more sentimental moods, allowing Napoleon to maintain some dignity to become the Emperor of Elba. Unfortunately, this act of goodwill put the conqueror of Europe on a small island off the coast of Naples, not very far away from the coast of France. And here's where Italy becomes important. Napoleon's brother-in-law is one of his marshals. This guy's name is Murat. Murat's actually one of the better cavalry commanders in Europe at the time. And Napoleon had made Murat the king of Naples. Hence the problem with Italy. Napoleon is on a small island in the Bay of Naples. His brother-in-law, who used to be one of his marshals, is now the king of Naples, which gives Napoleon a friendly ally with a sizable army, the ability to challenge Austria for supremacy in Italy. Now, within the Treaty of Fontainebleau, Alexander had made certain concessions to Napoleon and his family. Both Napoleon and his family were to be treated with respect, and they were to be richly provided for. Napoleon's been given the island of Elba to rule for his lifetime, meaning he gets to retain his imperial titles. He gets to take a 600-man contingent of the Imperial Guard with him. He also gets to take some cannon and a unit of Polish lancers, Polish cavalry. Now, to support his household and his new kingdom, he's to be paid a very generous yearly pension by the French crown, the French crown now being the new government in France. Napoleon's son is to be named King of Rome, given the Duchy of Parma and some of the surrounding area to rule. His mother's going to be regent until Napoleon becomes of age. Napoleon arrives in Elba in early May of 1814 and almost immediately throws himself into the civil, economic, and military reorganization of his new island kingdom. In the run-up to this podcast, I had the opportunity to read Andrew Roberts' biography on Napoleon, just titled Napoleon: A Life. And in there, what you come to see is Napoleon has a restless mind. I don't think it would have mattered when Napoleon was born. Living as he did in this time period, he's a conqueror. Had he been born today, he probably would have been, I don't know, a tech giant or some perennial startup founder in Silicon Valley. Napoleon had to constantly be busy. He could never sit still. Because of his new initiatives in Elba, he's in financial trouble almost immediately upon arrival. Now, while Napoleon was able to scrape together almost 4 million francs before he had left for Elba, his yearly civil, military, and household expenditures while there amounted to about 1.5 million francs. So judging by his burn rate, he had enough money for about 28 months. Now, as we mentioned before, the Treaty of Fontainebleau was supposed to provide him with a very generous pension, which equated to about 2.5 million francs a year. But, and this is the very important bit, Louis XVIII never paid him a single red cent, nor did he ever intend to. So there you are, you see Napoleon, he's on Elba, trying his best to leave well enough alone, to enjoy his retirement, to busy himself with the tasks of running his new island empire. But the industry on his island can't support his civil projects. They can't support the small military it has with it. It can't support his lifestyle. The French crown is not making good on the promises from the Treaty of Fontainebleau. Word is reaching him constantly of the strife in Vienna. There's constant rumors of plots to kill him and to have him removed. And some of those are to be taken quite seriously. So what is a man like Napoleon to do? What would you do? Sounds like Napoleon has two options. He can either stay on Elba like a good boy, waiting for the eventual assassin to show up to kill him, or he can do something bold, bet on his own luck, and take his chances. Now, nobody really knows when Napoleon makes up his mind to return to France. If you ask me personally, I don't think it's right away. I think early on, Napoleon was content to stay on Elba and would have been content to stay there had he felt relatively safe about doing so. Now, Napoleon had one of the better spy networks in Europe, very interested in staying abreast of what's going on to the continent. And his information trickles in, kind of starts to make up his mind for him. The Bourbons refuse to pay him. He's receiving news constantly that the Bourbons are unpopular at home. They're heavy-handed in their policies. They're trying to restore all the vestiges of the old Ancien Régime. They're treating the army poorly. Constant threat of Napoleon being removed by force from his island. Starting to feel that he gave up too easy in 1814. That he should have fought harder for his crown. Now, what is clear is that by February of 1815, his plan to escape is well underway. Now, on the surface, Napoleon's plans may look megalomaniacal, but I don't get the sense that Napoleon had any real choice. The Congress had pledged back in August of 1814 to make an effort to remove him from Elba. The first chance they got, send him to some place very far away. Constant rumors of assassination plots. And these weren't mere rumors. There were several unofficial plots within French royalist circles themselves to kill him. That's not counting Russian, Prussian, and British. And I think this alone gives Napoleon a legitimate excuse for escape. After all, he's bet on himself his whole life and he's always come up. Why not bet on yourself again? If you're just sitting there waiting for an assassin bullet, what's the point? Go big or go home. And it's not like Napoleon was naive. It's not like he didn't understand just how risky an attempt this was likely to be. But risky endeavors had always been part of his character. That's how you become a Napoleon Bonaparte. And even if the assassins don't get him first, it's not like he's going to have to wait very long to wake up one day and find the Royal Navy blockading his realm while Austrian soldiers are invading it from bases in Italy. The only question being, is this day going to come sooner or later? So he stops all improvements on the island, citing financial reasons as his cover. This doesn't go unnoticed. Napoleon's being watched the whole time. Castlereagh will actually get a letter from the same Major Campbell mentioned in the letter Metternich got on the 7th. Campbell being Napoleon's military British governor, a.k.a. his unofficial jailer, warning him of the dangerous situation being created by the withholding of his pension by the Bourbons. Around this same time, Talleyrand's going to have an audience with Alexander to discuss removing Murat in Italy. So Talleyrand goes to meet with Alexander. And Alexander in this meeting is much more interested in finding out why Louis XVIII had not paid Napoleon the 2.5 million francs he had owed him for the year. Talleyrand, hearing the emperor's question, thinks about it for a minute and responds with something like, you know, I don't know about that. I haven't been in France for 5 months. I have to find out. Alexander counters with a comment to the effect of, I have to insist on the King of France keeping his word and paying Napoleon what is promised him, because I made that promise. Talleyrand shines him on very politely, and then goes back to talking about Italy. On February 16th, Major Campbell, who's stationed in Elba, leaves for the Italian mainland. Now, his excuse is that he was going to visit his doctor. In reality, that visit was also going to include some time with his mistress. He's going to be gone about 2 weeks. This is Napoleon's window to escape. When the cat's away, the mouse will play. On the 26th of that in the month, about 10 days later, Napoleon will leave Elba on his brig while Campbell's in Italy. He takes 3 generals, 2 cannon, 1,000 men, and 150 of his Polish lancers with him without their horses, and he sets sail for France. He's essentially going to invade it with that. 3 generals, 2 cannons, 1,000 men, 150 Polish lancers with no horses. It's not like he's setting out for some pissant little country in Africa. He's invading one of the most powerful countries in Europe. A country which 18 months before this controlled the whole of the continent of Europe. This is one of the gutsier moves, well, ever. And to make it even more gutsy, Napoleon essentially calls the shot before he leaves. Almost like Babe Ruth. And he says, I shall reach Paris without firing a shot, end quote. 3 days later, on March 1st, he lands safely in southern France and starts his march on Paris. And within this march to Paris, there's going to be a bunch of miraculous things that are going to happen in succession. And the first miraculous thing is that he made it safely from Elba to France. On the way, he passes by some British ships going the opposite direction. They're not able to stop him. He's spotted by a French ship on the horizon. They're not able to stop him. There's no random storm that blows up in the Mediterranean that could have blown him off course or sunk his little flotilla. The weather was great. And look at his landing spot, southern France. Napoleon's not popular in southern France. It's very mercantile there, and his trade war with Great Britain had wrecked all that. They had been forced to supply a lot of food material for his various campaigns. And Napoleon wasn't known for paying the highest prices for things. In general, the people in southern France saw very little improvement in their lives from the spoils of this grand empire that Napoleon was creating. They were always paying high taxes, and they were always constantly supplying a steady stream of conscripts to feed the beast. The fact that Napoleon wasn't torn apart by the locals when he landed at the dock is another one of these amazing things that happens along the way. Instead, the people come out of their houses to look at the former emperor. They come out of their houses and look at him, and they talk to Napoleon, and he talked back to them. And the people did this in a very familiar way. They weren't always nice about it. And here's the thing with Napoleon. You can look at Napoleon and call him a butcher and call him a but he was always surprisingly friendly and approachable. Napoleon was just fine with the rubes having their fun with him. They'd call out to him, he'd say something back, usually with something pretty witty, stop and give the people one of his little famous harangues. They'd go from wanting to kill him to laughing at him. In that way, Napoleon almost reminds me of like an Abraham Lincoln. I know. Kind of hard to compare Napoleon to Abraham Lincoln, but he has that kind of quality to him. Almost like a folksy quality that the common people could relate to. His soldiers loved it. Now, once Napoleon's in France, the time for the hard decisions had come. And that is how to get to Paris, because there's 2 possible routes he can take. The first one's through southern France, which was very accessible, but very hostile, and crawling with royalist troops. The second route is much less accessible as it goes through the very dangerous French Alps. It's steep, it's narrow, and in the spring it's still covered in ice. This is the path that Napoleon chooses to take. He deems it less risky. Rather face the elements than have to face the angry country people and royalist troops. Napoleon, ever swift of movement, knows that he's got to cover the ground quickly before the Bourbons know where he's going. If he can catch some things off by surprise, there's not going to be a whole lot of royal troops in between him and Paris. So by March 7th, when Metternich receives the letter Napoleon's been loose in France for 6 days. And this is a guy known for his speed of movement. He could be anywhere. In fact, he's averaging 15 to 20 miles a day. French government obviously received word much quicker than the folks in Vienna did. And so their solution was the whole thing was basically just to ignore it, pretend not to be overly concerned. So after his 8:15 meeting with the Tsar on March 7th, Napoleon's hosting a meeting of the Big Five by 10 a.m. Talleyrand is the first to arrive. He reads the dispatch for himself and then asks Metternich, "Do you know where Napoleon is headed?" Metternich responds, "The reports say nothing about it." Talleyrand responds with speculation. He'll land on the Italian coast and fling himself into Switzerland. And Metternich responds, quote, "No, he'll go straight to Paris," end quote. Now, nothing about what's going on is clear or obvious. And Metternich really has no idea where Napoleon is at this time. This is just his hunch. Now, if you were going to trust somebody about their hunches regarding Napoleon, Metternich's a pretty good guy to trust. Because Metternich had nothing but hunches in 1814 and was basically able to read Napoleon like a book. When the Prussians and Wellington arrive a couple of minutes later, it becomes clear not only that Metternich and Talleyrand have no idea where Napoleon is, but that nobody in Vienna has any idea where Napoleon is or what his intentions are. The only thing the members of the Big Five can do is try to keep things quiet and work to wrap up the conference quickly so they can start focusing on this Napoleon problem they now have. Now, luckily for everybody, at the beginning of this, Napoleon does not have an army. But it's not going to take long for him to acquire one, being Napoleon and all. So there's only two questions that remain. How long is it going to take him to raise an army? And how many French soldiers and citizens were pissed off enough to support the return of the former emperor? And it's a fair question to ask because Louis XVIII and the Bourbons had made so many mistakes during their short 9-month restoration. So many mistakes, in fact, that most people were starting to forget about the worst excesses of the Napoleonic regime. Louis XVIII and the Bourbons had done very little to reassure the people of France that they would not restore the Ancien regime, which was what they didn't want. The people of France may have been tired of Napoleon and may have been nostalgic for the monarchy, but they were not in any mood to go backward politically. Now, Louis, at the beginning of his reign, did reissue a Charter of Rights, but he declared 1814 as the 18th year of his regime, basically wiping out all the stuff that had happened in between Louis XVII having his head lopped off and Louis XVIII taking power. It's as if the revolution and the republic and the empire had never happened. And this little bit of revisionist history had irritated both liberals and conservatives alike. The list of the blunders of Louis XVIII is long and distinguished. So I'll just give you the highlights. Got rid of the tricolor, which is the French flag. Cut the army and veteran pensions. Gave high-ranking army positions to émigrés that had fought against France. Done everything possible to alienate the Imperial Guard. The piece de resistance being trying to replace them with a brand new royalist unit. Then he had gone and forced large numbers of officers into early retirement and then put them on half pay. So as far as the army's concerned, Napoleon returning is starting to look really good to them, especially the rank-and-file soldiers. And quite frankly, Napoleon is starting to look good to a lot of people in Vienna. Just as Louis was doing in France, over the past 5 months, the plenipotentiaries of the Big Five had also done a really good job of alienating the delegations of a lot of the smaller countries of Europe that were in attendance. One of them being Murat in Naples. Talleyrand's been trying to have him thrown out of Naples since he arrived. Metternich doesn't like him because he's threatening Austrian control in Italy. Most of the Poles are disillusioned with Alexander over the whole having their own state thing. And remember, a lot of Poles fought very loyally and very well for Napoleon. One report stated that, quote, "the Poles overflowed with delight," end quote, upon receiving the news of Napoleon's escape. Now, here's the thing. If Poland rebels, the coalition's now going to have an enemy in its rear with Murat to the south and the possibility of Napoleon to the west. The Bavarians and the Saxons are not happy about losing territory to the heavy-handed Prussians. They already know what their fate's going to be under the Big Five. May get a better deal from Napoleon. Then you have small pockets of resistance in your center. Well, you might have a threat to your rear, a threat to your south, and a threat to your front. And then there's this. The always mercurial Alexander might just have one of his periodic evolutions of mind and decide that Napoleon is actually his natural ally after all and make his own separate peace. Because he's not going to get what he wants from Metternich, Castlereagh, and Wellington, and Talleyrand. Now, if you feel that this might be a scenario that's a little unbelievable, now, if you find this scenario a little unbelievable, remember that Napoleon had spent the better part of a decade masterfully playing the heads of Europe off against one another with really good success. So, while the plenipotentiaries of the Big Five are trying to keep things secret, another one of these miraculous things in Napoleon's miraculous return to power is occurring. And this episode's famous in Napoleonic lore. Napoleon has his run-in with the famed 5th Infantry Regiment. Occurs about 15 miles outside of a little French town called Grenoble. And Napoleon's small column runs into a much larger infantry regiment. Now, Napoleon's marching at the head of the column. He's with his Polish lancers. He has his old guard behind him. The 5th Regiment's arrayed out in front of him in firing lines. Not a good thing to be walking up into. It was very risky. But Napoleon, being Napoleon, he walks up to the royal troops and asks them, quote, if they wish to kill their emperor. Napoleon walks up to the royal troops, opens his great coat, and asks them if they wish to kill their emperor. And instead of the men erupting in fire, the 5th Infantry Regiment erupts in cheers of Vive l'Empereur. Now, this story gets told a number of different ways. Some of them extremely dramatic and well embellished. I've heard it three ways myself. My favorite is Napoleon's version of the story. And this is from Andrew Roberts' biography on Napoleon. It's a very jovial, old comrade type of attitude. Napoleon goes up to one of the men in the ranks, extends his hand, and says, quote, what, you old rascal? Were you about to fire on your emperor? And the soldier, who has to be bewildered, looks at him and replies, look here, and shows Napoleon an unloaded musket. Now, Napoleon attributed the success of the whole thing to him having his old guard with him. Remember, these are the veteran of the veteran in the French army. You know, he says that it was, quote, the bearskin helmets that did the business, end quote. Napoleon's encounter with the 5th is the first time that a unit of actual soldiers will defect to Napoleon. By the end of the day on the 7th, he's in the city of Grenoble, where, quote, the inhabitants were proud to have the conqueror of Europe within their walls, end quote. By the time he left, he would be 5 army regiments richer. He'd have a larger cachet of artillery, guns, powder, and other military supplies that he's going to need to prosecute a takeover of France. The most important aspect of his adventures in Grenoble is that he's 200 miles north of his original landing spot. On March 10th, the first real news of Napoleon's whereabouts reaches Vienna. People are absolutely shocked to discover that he's in France and not in Italy, as most people had predicted. And the fact that he's traveling up the Alps is even more shocking. Now, naturally, the closer Napoleon gets to Paris, the more popular support he enjoys. In fact, on the 10th, Lyon, which is France's second city, goes over to him. And when this news is published, it leads to massive losses on both the French and Viennese stock exchanges. Now, the one group of people who were absolutely excited as kids on Christmas to hear about the news of Napoleon were the Prussians, because they're generally excited about the prospect of war and the opportunity to rich themselves on the corpse of France. Some of the more extreme opinions in Prussia want to just wipe France off the map. They wanted to carve it up into its little provincial parts like Burgundy and Champagne and Avignon and Brittany and Aquitaine and Normandy, and then auction those little provincial parts off to other countries to pay for the war. On the 13th of March, Talleyrand pulls off a first in diplomatic history. Talleyrand understood very well that a second war with Napoleon is going to be devastating for both the people and the nation of France. It's one of the things that motivates him to sell Napoleon out in the first place. Talleyrand knows that whatever is to happen in the spring of 1815, France is not likely to come out with as good as a deal as it got in 1814. So he comes up with a clever plan to draw a distinction, a legal distinction, between Napoleon and the people and nation of France itself. He draws up a declaration that names Napoleon and not France as the enemy. As David King put it, quote, "Declaring Napoleon an outlaw would focus the animosity on him, not the French people. And, moreover, it would serve to deprive traitors of the confidence and to give courage to the loyal." End quote. This will be the first time in the history of Europe that war is declared on an individual and not the people of the state he is the head of. By March 20th, it's all over for the Bourbons as Napoleon enters Paris. Louis XVIII having fled Paris in the early morning hours of the 20th. You can say what you want about Napoleon, but you can't say that he's stupid. Kissinger had stated that Napoleon's downfall in 1814 was not understanding his limitations. And Napoleon's going to learn from his mistakes this time around. He doesn't couch his return in personal glory, imperial adventure, or the God-given rights of absolute monarchy. He's too smart for that. Rather, Napoleon presents his return as an internal French matter, and therefore outside international concern. He doesn't even attempt to assume his old imperial titles. He very quickly calls for what's essentially a constitutional convention. He has every intention of establishing a constitutional monarchy, very similar to his archenemy, Great Britain. And yet the genius of Talleyrand as labeling Napoleon the outlaw essentially makes that move null and void. The Allied powers still have the quasi-legal ground to declare war against him. With the Allies preparing for their military invasion, Napoleon needs to find a way to buy time to equip and train his army. When Louis XVIII had fled Paris, he remembered to take most of the treasury and the crown jewels with him, but he had forgotten to take all of the crown's diplomatic papers from the last 9 months. So one of the first things Napoleon does is he does this mass document dump WikiLeaks style. He publishes all the secret negotiations and treaties between the Bourbons, Great Britain, Austria, and the Russians and the Prussians. As we've detailed over the past couple of episodes, there's a lot of duplicitous stuff there. There's some very damaging things there. And that's exactly what Napoleon is counting on. He's hoping that this is going to exasperate some of the internal disagreements between the big four, that he can create dissension among the Allies. And then couple that with the general war fatigue that's being felt all throughout Europe, that might just allow him to avoid a conflict, or for the very least, delay it long enough until he can get his military political positions worked out. That, coupled with the general war fatigue gripping Europe, might just give him the time necessary to either avoid a conflict, or at the very least, delay it long enough until he can consolidate his military and his political position. The document certainly calls an outrage. One of the things that gets published is the secret treaty between Austria, Great Britain, and France against Russia. Alexander is not pleased, but then again, he's not really surprised. All this does is confirm things that he had suspected already. Has what must have been a very awkward meeting with Metternich, but then basically forgives him and states that they need to focus on Napoleon. Just goes to prove the mercurial nature of Alexander. Actually, the biggest outrage from this document dump comes in Great Britain, and it's with the opposition party. Remember, Great Britain's in an election cycle, and the opposition party basically felt that they had been lied to by their government and had been led into a false war. The Allies certainly have egg on their face, but ultimately it's a small matter. It's not going to be enough to buy Napoleon the time he really needs. News of Napoleon's arrival in Paris doesn't arrive in Vienna until the end of March. but it's going to light a fire under the asses of the plenipotentiaries to finish the outstanding business of the conference as quickly as they can. Now, luckily for them, this catalyst comes at a time when most of the big questions had already been settled, and they just need to tie up some loose ends. The most immediate of those concerns, of those loose ends, is what to do with Marat. And the real question supporting Marat in March of 1814 is whether or not he's going to support Napoleon or make a deal with the Allies. If Marat supports Napoleon, then he's going to be able to occupy the tension of an awful lot of Austrian troops that could be used to reinforce Wellington and the Prussians. The worst nightmare of the Allied military planners is that if Marat's able to tie up Austrian troops, then it gives Napoleon a chance to engage Wellington and the Prussians individually and destroy them individually. If Marat joins the Allies, however, it's going to free up a huge number of Austrian troops, and it might even provide some support for Marat's Italian troops. Luckily for the Allies, Marat puts all this conjecture to rest when he essentially declares war on Austria on March 30th and then puts his army in the field. Now, despite what you may be thinking, this is really extremely unhelpful for Napoleon. In fact, it's downright counterproductive. But what can you expect from a flamboyant cavalry officer? Marat's march to glory is short-lived when his army is destroyed in a battle over May 2nd and May 3rd. The Austrians waste no time in consolidating their position in northern Italy, imposing control almost immediately. In April and May 1815, the Congress begins to wrap up in, well, the most unceremonious of ways. Everything's kind of settled in basically what would be a half-assed fashion. It's how quickly can we get this done and settled so we can focus our attention militarily on Napoleon. Agreements are made in a very hasty and haphazard way. And then the party slowly begins to break up. As historian David King put it, quote, by the end of May, most of the guests had left town, either to face Napoleon, return home, or head off elsewhere in search of the next adventure. Then he quotes the Duchess of Seguin, Vienna is becoming a desert, end quote. By June 9th, a final act is submitted and signed. And the final act is like a compendium of all the settlements that have occurred in the last 9 months. They're put into one document, and it's just called the final act. It's signed by the 8 signatories of the Treaty of Paris in the reception hall of the Hofburg, with most of the remaining diplomatic missions in attendance. The events of June 9th are going to be the first and only time the, quote, Congress of Vienna would ever meet in any official capacity. And David King points out the irony of the situation by saying, quote, many of the key figures at the Congress were not even present. The host himself, Emperor Francis, had already left for the battlefield. Tsar Alexander and King Frederick William of Prussia were not there either, having left about 2 weeks before. As for the British team, Castlereagh was long gone, and the Duke of Wellington was somewhere outside of Brussels. With the exception of Metternich and Talleyrand, two genius survivors, none of the main leaders actually signed the treaty that concluded the Congress of Vienna. And Talleyrand had only been able to stay for the signing by deliberately and repeatedly disobeying the king's orders. End quote. And in the end, there were no grand balls, no gaudy parades, no extravagant parties, or grand spectacles to mark the close of the Congress. It just simply broke up and faded into memory, like a party that had lingered too long. When Wellington arrives in Belgium, he has a most unpleasant surprise waiting for him. Now, if you recall in 1814, Wellington had one of the crack armies of Europe that he had used to prosecute this thing called the Peninsular Campaign. And that's a campaign that had started in Spain and had fought Napoleon's contingents there and had met up with the Austrian, Prussian, and Russian armies coming in from the east. Well, that army is not waiting for him now in 1815. What's waiting for him in Belgium is just a mere shadow of what he had had the year before. Most of his veteran troops are either on their way home or they've already been discharged. He only has about 12,000 poorly trained troops to work with, if you can call them that. He's got an inexperienced staff, he's got questions of loyalty, and most of his army speaks German. But whatever Wellington's challenges might have been, they pale in comparison to those being faced by Napoleon. Napoleon has major financial trouble. Wellington never has to deal with finances as being a problem. France is hugely indebted from 25 years of war. They've been mismanaged badly by the Bourbons for the last 9 months, plus Louis XVIII's runoff with the treasury. France's income's only a third of what it had been under Napoleon a mere 18 months before. Napoleon's already got a shaky political situation, and now he's got to do something that's never popular ever. He's got to impose new emergency taxes. His army's in worse shape than Wellington's. He's got more troops to work with. He's got 120,000 troops, but they're poorly equipped. They lack shoes, boots, uniforms, muskets, food, ammo, powder. You name it, they don't have it. A huge part of an army's effectiveness is leadership and talented leadership. And most of the French army's talented leadership's been removed and replaced by loyalist lackeys. Most of Napoleon's veteran troops have either been dismissed or they've been put on half pay. And this is where Napoleon reminds you of why he's different. Because he, in a very short period of time, is going to transform this French rabble into an effective and lethal military force, and he's going to do it in less than 3 months. He goes on a massive recruiting spree. He begs, borrows, and steals everything he needs to conduct a modern military campaign. He orders new muskets, pistols, boots, uniforms, cartridge weapons, food, horses, and the list goes on and on and on. He has no idea where he's going to get the money for this, but it's just by his sheer personality that he's able to convince everyone that he's going to be able to get the money to pay for it. Of course, this doesn't exactly make Napoleon popular at home. The year before, the people had been fed up with Napoleon. It was only when they had to endure 9 months of Bourbon incompetence that it made Napoleon look good to the French people. Most of the provincial authorities knew that Napoleon had no idea where he was going to get the money to pay for all the stuff that he was ordering. The new taxes and the new recruitment quotas are stirring up resentment in the west of France. And the pendulum swings the other way as the more and more that France is asked to sacrifice under Napoleon, the more and more they forget the incompetencies of the Bourbons, and Louis starts to look good again. Time is what Napoleon needs, but it's not on his side. If he had time, he wouldn't have to push so hard. And while he may have more troops than both the British and the Prussians in Belgium, he's going to be vastly outnumbered when the Austrians and the Russians arrive, which they're sure to do in only a matter of time. Napoleon's going to be forced to act first. His opening salvo is to use diplomacy as a weapon. His first attempt was that WikiLeaks document dump. His second is to try and convince Metternich and Alexander to make a separate peace with France. Remember, all of Europe is worn out from the last 15-20 years of constant warfare. Austria and Russia especially, I mean, they've both been bled basically white, financially speaking. Remember, to even put armies in the field the previous year, they had to have financial assistance from Great Britain. Alexander's so broke in April of 1815 that he says he's not even going to bother raising an army unless he is certain he's going to receive funding from the British. Doesn't really matter, though. Diplomacy is just going to buy Napoleon a matter of time, but it's not going to stop his enemies. So some of his generals come up with an interesting idea. The merits of this idea is, again, it buys him time, which he has precious little, and it allows him to consolidate his position. They come up with the idea of letting the Allies invade. They figure the British and the Prussians aren't going to be ready for anything until the summer, and they're probably going to wait for support anyway. So nothing's likely to happen until July at the earliest. And if the Allies invade, discontent for Napoleon's going to evaporate basically overnight. They figure the country's resolve is going to be strengthened. This is going to allow Napoleon to conduct a defensive campaign so he's closer to his lines of supply. And they may even get the added bonus of a guerrilla uprising against the Allied armies from the French people. Now, Napoleon being Napoleon, dismisses it completely out of hand. Napoleon figures if he waits for the Allies to invade, then they're going to come with at least 700,000 to 800,000 men. The longer he waits, the stronger the Allies get. Napoleon also knows that victory, any victory, is going to help resolve domestic issues. And Napoleon knows that he cannot afford any setbacks. The Allies might be able to take a defeat here or there so long as they're tactical and not strategic. It would just be an inconvenience to them. One defeat for Napoleon in the game's up, he realizes in the early stages just how much of a house of cards his position is now in France. So Napoleon decides to do what he always does. He decides he's going to take the fight to the Allies. They're weak, I'm weak, but I'm Napoleon, and I'm going to hit them now and roll the dice and take my chances, betting on myself. Napoleon's strategy is to march into Belgium and destroy either Wellington or Blücher, who commands the Prussian army, before they have time to join forces. He would then regroup and overwhelm and destroy the remaining army. It's essentially a divide-and-conquer strategy. Instead of allowing the British and the Prussians to mutually support each other in the field, if he can decisively march into Belgium, engage one army, and destroy it quickly, he stands a really good shot of being able to do the same to the other army. Now, it's one thing if he's able to destroy the Prussians first. It's a big blow to the Allies, but they can still carry on. If he gets to destroy the British first, the entire game's over for the Allies. That's their bank. A war in 1850 is extremely unpopular in London. Losing their army and Wellington in the field would absolutely destroy the resolve. There's no more financial backing. The other Allies can't prosecute the war. Napoleon remains Emperor of France. Moves like these are right out of Napoleon's playbook. And he's actually in pretty good shape for this campaign. This is not some harebrained idea he has. This is really the best shot he has to win this upcoming campaign coming in the summer of 1815. Because he holds some advantages on paper. Napoleon holds an advantage in men and firepower over both the British and the Prussians individually, but not combined. So on June 12th, Napoleon quietly leaves Paris for Belgium to win back his throne, and this time for good. When you read biographies concerning Napoleon and his life, it becomes clear that ever since the Russian campaign, it feels like he's lost a little bit of swagger. That air of invincibility isn't quite there. But make no mistake, in early June of 1815, Napoleon's on top of his game. And he completely catches the British and the Prussians by surprise when he arrives in Belgium without warning. There's a battle on the 16th where he strikes hard and fast, and he strikes right at the hinge point between the two armies. He's going to separate them. Napoleon commands the main assault on the Prussians, while Ney attacks the British. And Napoleon almost destroys the Prussians right then and there. It's decisive. Historian Andrew Roberts notes just how impressive a feat this is when you consider that the vast majority of Napoleon's army is made up of raw recruits. To do something this fast and this decisive with new recruits is unheard of. He took a rabble and he pulled a veteran army's ability out of it. This is why Napoleon's one of the preeminent soldiers of history. Doesn't matter when he had been born, what army he was going to command, he was always going to be good at it. Now the key phrase when considering this battle from the 16th is almost destroyed. While Napoleon's able to win a decisive tactical victory, the Prussians are still pretty much intact, and they have the ability to retreat to the north. Now, when they're retreating to the north, they're retreating away from their supply lines. Usually, when you retreat back along your supply lines, so you don't lose them. The Prussians are doing kind of the opposite. They're retreating away from their supply line because they're trying to preserve their ability to link up with the British. And this is where things start to go wrong for Napoleon, because he doesn't immediately follow up the attack on the Prussians on the 17th. He hangs around and waits till midday, and then he splits up his force and he sends about 33,000 men to chase down the Prussians while planning to engage Wellington and the British on the next day, on the 18th. Now, what's ironic about this is how un-Napoleonic this move is. This violates one of his very own military maxims. The idea that, quote, no force should be detached on the eve of a battle because affairs may change during the night, either by retreat of the enemy or by arrival of large reinforcements to enable him to resume the offensive and counteract your previous arrangements, end quote. Napoleon very well knew that you should not split up your force on the eve of a battle. And yet he does it anyway. And he does it because he thinks that the Prussians are shattered, thinks that they're heading east, and he basically writes them off. doesn't think they're capable of conducting offensive operations. The British suffer only a minor tactical defeat, and they redeploy their forces to Waterloo. Now, the reason the upcoming battle, the Battle of Waterloo, takes place at Waterloo is because that is where Wellington wishes it to take place. Wellington had seen this battlefield a year before, would claim that he had kept it in his pocket, and it has a lot of things that he likes. Wellington's a big terrain guy, very famous for implementing something called the reverse slope. He loves these battlefields that have nice long ridges. And what Wellington would do is he'd line up just a little bit of his army on the top or the front of the ridge and line up the rest of it behind the ridge, providing him two benefits. Number one, they'd be reasonably well protected from artillery because he didn't really have howitzers in heavy use in 1815. And two, you could hide your numbers from the enemy leadership. They couldn't always tell what you had there. The battlefield's small. It's only like 3 miles wide and like a mile and a half deep. And the battlefield's got some nice defensive obstacles. So when he gets there first, he can fortify himself for a little bit. It's got two farmhouses, and they basically sit on the left and right flank of the battlefield. So he can kind of anchor his position with these defensive obstacles. He can have most of his troops up on the backside of the ridge, and he's going to force Napoleon to attack him essentially uphill. And as Andrew Roberts puts it, Napoleon, quote, fought one of the worst commanded battles of the Napoleonic War on the 18th, end quote. And yet, as bad as Napoleon may have commanded that battle, as Wellington so famously put it, quote, it was the nearest run thing you had ever seen in your life. Waterloo is the battle of the 19th century. Certainly in Europe, maybe in the world, and it's a rarity in military history. Because its outcome actually causes the world to change. See, most battles are tactically important. D-Day was a tactically important battle. Right? It's a game changer, but the Second World War didn't end at D-Day. It still drug on for another year. Gettysburg, tactically important. Has strategic implications, but it doesn't end the Civil War. Only a handful of battles anywhere in history have actually changed things, where things were one way the day before the battle and were a completely different way after the battle. Now, while this is not a military history podcast, we're going to spend some time here because Waterloo is so critically important to the story because it makes everything in Vienna relevant. Everything that has happened at the Congress of Vienna will be made sticky by the outcome of the battle that's going to take place here. The only reason Vienna is not some failed peace conference is because of the result of Waterloo. In his book Waterloo, Bernard Cornwell essentially describes Waterloo as like a play, stating that it can be divided into acts, right? It's got a first act, a second act, a third act. So the first act is this diversionary attack that the French launch on the Duke's right against one of those farmhouses, against one of those defensive obstacles, right? Hoping to draw a bunch of his troops to support, and that way they can launch a real attack on the left flank. And that fails. Then there's this great cavalry assault against the Duke's center, where the British have to famously form these infantry squares to fight it off. And the third act is this glorious and doomed final assault by Napoleon's undefeated Imperial Guard straight up the slopes as the Prussians are arriving. But like all things in life, the battle is far more complex than any description can possibly capture. Wellington once said that, quote, the history of a battle is not unlike the history of a ball. Some individuals may recollect all the little events of which the great result is the battle won or lost, but no individual can recollect the order in which or the exact moment at which they occurred, which makes all the difference as to their value or importance, end quote. If you ask me the way I would describe Waterloo, I would describe it as a brawl. A long, grueling, bloody brawl. And by the end of that brawl, there's going to be 65,000 casualties. 40,000 of which are deaths. You know, in American history, we in the United States love to talk about battles in the U.S. Civil War that would take place 5 decades later. You know, the famous Battle of Antietam, the single bloodiest day in American history. Or the great three-day Battle of Gettysburg, the worst battle of the U.S. Civil War. Waterloo has 15,000 more casualties than Gettysburg does. In his own reminiscence on the Battle of Waterloo, Wellington would say, quote, "I hope to God that I have fought my last battle. It is a bad thing to be always fighting. While in the thick of it, I am much too occupied to feel anything, but it is retching just afterwards. It is quite impossible to think of glory. Both mind and feeling are exhausted. I am wretched even at the moment of victory. And they always say that next to a battle lost, the greatest misery is a battle gained. Not only do you lose your dear friends with whom you have been living, but you are forced to leave the wounded behind you. To be sure, one tries to do the best for them, but how little is that? At such moments, every feeling in your breast is dead. I am now just beginning to retain my natural spirit, but I never wish for any more fighting," end quote. By nature, I'm a naturally curious person. I've heard other history podcasters and sometimes other writers talk about this idea that they have this natural curiosity, this fascination to want to be in a hot air balloon above one of these old world battles. You know, because it would answer so many questions we have. Like, for example, because we haven't lined up in battle formations like this, in great big lines of battle and fired shots at each other, we start to forget things. Like, for example, we don't really know what cavalry does when it charges into a block of infantry holding bayoneted muskets. And still further, we don't know what happens when one block of men charges into another one with these sharp, pointy bayonets. Do they skewer each other? Do they run away? What happens? And it's natural curiosity that we want to see that, because we have those burning desire to answer those questions. And I'm guilty of that too, until I'm reminded of just how horrible this battle must have been. And I think if I were in that hot air balloon, I would be ashamed of my curiosity. I'd be ashamed of my voyeurism. And I think it would be an understatement to say that I would be feeling some of the wretchedness that Wellington describes. In doing the research for this, I had some time to reflect on what this battlefield must have looked like, must have felt like, must have smelt like. And I think it would truly be the stuff of nightmare. A lot of the action that takes place in this battlefield, even though you have these mass blocks of men slamming into each other, it takes place on the unit level because a lot of the ground is broken up. Bernard Cornwell in his book describes actions taking place between companies, in regiments, almost in total seclusion, because one regiment might be on one side of a little gully and another one might be on the other. And so it looks like all these fights are taking place against small units. Plus, these black powder rifles just throw an amazing amount of smoke and haze into the air. They had to be blinding. They had to be deafening. They had to be choking. In the immediate aftermath of the battle, Brussels becomes one giant field hospital. David King describes the situation by saying that carts, quote, "carts of mangled, bloodied, and bandaged soldiers rattled through the streets and dropped off the wounded onto beds of straw around the city. Citizens cared for as many in their homes as possible and carried water to the thirsty. One surgeon described the ordeal of continual operations on the wounded for 13 straight hours until, as he put it, his clothes were, quote, quoting the surgeon, stiff with blood and his arms powerless with the exertion of using the knife. Unfortunately for the soldiers, it was a dreadful experience. The rushed and overworked surgeons labored without the benefit of anesthesia or sophisticated instruments," end quote. The combined armies of Wellington and Blücher had defeated Napoleon just a mere 9 days after the signing of the final act, thus ensuring the Congress of Vienna would be the arbiter of Europe's future. On June 22nd, after being given an ultimatum by the French legislature, Napoleon abdicates for the second time, not wishing to, quote, "drench Paris in blood." It was 3 p.m. in the afternoon. Napoleon's return from exile lasts just a mere 100 days. The peace process in Paris after his return would last another 133 days. The result would be this thing called the Treaty of Paris. And it's a far more punitive treaty than anything that had been dreamed up the year before in Vienna. France will be settled with war reparations, plus she'll have to lose additional territory, including a couple of places called Alsace and Lorraine. All the work that Talleyrand had done in the last 18 months now lie in absolute ruin. Plus, he's dismissed from service to the French crown. Now, while the treaty is punitive, it's not going to be as punitive as the Prussians would have liked. But as usual, punishment never seems to be enough for the Prussians. But nevertheless, France is humiliated. We used a quote in episode 2 from William Thackeray's book Vanity Fair, in which Thackeray writes, quote, "Vanity Fair is a very vain and wicked, foolish place full of all sorts of humbugs and falseness and pretensions. Not a moral place, certainly, nor a very merry one, although very noisy. A world where everyone is striving for what is not worth having." End quote. It's only through the lens of history that the Congress of Vienna has come to be seen as anything other than a vanity fair. Gentz summed up the whole thing very wonderfully when reflecting on it in his diary in the summer of 1815, saying that, quote, "Never had the expectations of the general public been as excited as they were before the opening of the solemn assembly. People were confident of a general reform of the political system of Europe, of a guarantee of eternal peace, even for the return of a golden age. Yet, it produced only restitutions decided beforehand by the force of arms, arrangements between the great powers unfavorable to the future balance and the maintenance of peace in Europe, and some quite arbitrary rearrangements in the possessions of the lesser states, but not one act of a more elevated character, not one great measure of public order or security which might compensate humanity for any part of its long suffering or reassure it as to its future." End quote. Taken in its totality, the Congress of Vienna is really just a reactionary movement of the European conservatives. It's an attempt to try and stuff the genie back in the bottle. It's an anti-liberal movement. Had guys like Metternich had his way, the whole ancien regime of the previous century would have had been restored. But to be fair, we have the hindsight of history to tell us that. The guys like Metternich, they felt this was the only move to preserve equilibrium and security in Europe. It's of little consequence, as the whole congressional system will be dead by 1822. Whatever status quo it had created would be ripped apart by 1830. Because in July of that year, two of the most hard-fought issues at Vienna are going to disappear from the map. Due to political unrest in Russia, they're going to abolish and annex the independent Kingdom of Poland, and Britain's defensive state of the Kingdom of the Netherlands is going to break apart into Holland and Belgium. The 1840s are a period of great civil unrest in every capital in Europe except for London. In 1851, another Bonaparte will become King of France and effectively become the final death nail in everything the Congress had set out to achieve. The only real, quote, winners of the Congress are Great Britain and, as unlikely as it may seem, Prussia. Great Britain gained its massive overseas empire. It's the undisputed economic champion in Europe for the next 100 years. And it's going to be left virtually unchallenged except for some Russian meddling over in the Balkans and in India. Prussia, through its annexation of Saxony, is going to gain a more homogeneous German-speaking population. It's going to acquire the rich iron and coal it needs to feed its industrialization. And it's going to be left in a position where it's going to be able to consolidate its territory over the next 5 decades. It's going to replace Austria as the undisputed German power in the region after the Austro-Prussian War. And everyone else is going to be a loser in one way or another. France will go through one period of civil unrest after another, ultimately culminating in its defeat by Prussia in 1870. Russia, who's in a generally good position in the immediate aftermath of Vienna, will squander away whatever advantages it had been gained by failing to reform throughout the 19th century and join the rest of the Western world. Austria is going to be bled dry by its desire to maintain its dominance in Italy, and both Prussia and Austria are going to disappear, at least in their imperial form, from the maps of Europe after the First World War. Perhaps the Vanity Fair in Vienna's most lasting legacy will be the foremost destructive decades, the first 4 decades in the 20th century in Western history. But thank God we got our century of middle-class love. This is Thomas Mitchell, signing off. In researching this podcast series, I've really had the opportunity to read some wonderful books. You know, David King's Vienna, 1814, Henry Kissinger's A World Restored, Adam Zamosky's Rights of Peace, Andrew Roberts' Napoleon, a biography, and Bernard Cornwell's Waterloo. About 3 years ago, I had the opportunity to fall in love again with the written word, specifically in its audiobook format. Now, I get into debates all the time with my mom and my sister about whether listening to audiobooks is the same as reading. It may not be, but I don't care. I call it reading anyway. I read about 40 books a year, at least I try to. About 3/4 of those are audiobooks. And I love it. It's really some of the best money I spend. I constantly joke that I spend more money on books than I do on drugs, which also sadly happens to be true. Or maybe not, depending on how you look at things. In a very wonderful development, Turning Points now happens to be sponsored by Audible. Now, while I read mostly nonfiction, I had the opportunity over the last couple of weeks to read two books by a single author that I adore, Anthony Bourdain's Kitchen Confidential and Medium Raw. Every once in a while, I have to take a break from the nonfiction genre, and it's really a pleasant surprise to get lost in somebody else's passion. And I would invite you, if you're missing some of that in these crazy times and a need for escapism, perhaps it might be time to look to the world of books for that escape. And in doing so, we'd like to offer you a free audiobook trial to Audible. You can find it at www.audibletrial.com/turningpoints. That's www.audibletrial.com/turningpoints. Audible has literally hundreds of thousands of titles, all of the highest quality. There is every genre to suit your need. If you want to read something in the nonfiction category, I'd invite you to pick up one of the wonderful books that we used in the research of this podcast. If you're looking for something different, maybe take a look at a guy at Bourdain and see how that fits your fancy. Whatever it is to you, I hope you find some passion from the written word in the way I do. I want to thank you guys for your listenership and for your support of the podcast. Remember to subscribe, rate, and review. This is Thomas Mitchell, signing off.